I was living in the north end of Halifax at the time, so 92, I just started boxing that first year. And so I was grounded. I don't know what I did, but I was grounded. And my mom said that I had to come with her to the North Branch Library to listen to a keynote speaker that was going to be presenting. So she didn't tell me who this guy was, so I'm going begrudgingly. I sit down there in the room, and there's, you know, a bunch of people in there. North End of Halifax is a predominantly black neighborhood, or used to be. Now it's been infiltrated by the LGBTQ community. It's crazy. There's not a sidewalk that doesn't have a rainbow on it.
Oh, wow.
It's nuts. Mm. Yeah, mm. But anyway, so... yeah, so I moved back there, and it was like basically that's where the instances of, you know, kind of recognizing the difference occurred, right?
Mm.
So, you know, like, yeah. Ask me another question.
Okay. I got one here for you.
You know, a lot of champions in your industry have been... prisoners, Bernard Hopkins,
yes.
The Executioner, Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm.
There's the segue I was looking for, Digi.
Yeah.
So back to the story I was just telling you about. So I'm listening to this guy now, right? And I'm halfway listening and halfway not. And I hear, all of a sudden I hear, triple murder. Okay, now, what? Now I'm looking at the man, and all of a sudden now I hear boxing. Okay, now I'm paying attention. I'm sitting in my chair listening to this man.
Mm.
And now I start to hear the story of Reuben Hurricane Carter, right? So afterwards, you know, I really was impacted by that. I had an opportunity to actually stand up, ask him a question, shake his hand, and stuff like that.
Mm.
So I was about 11 years old at the time, just turned 11.
Mm.
So,
fast forward. We got a caller, champ.
Okay, we'll put that on hold.
Peace. Who we got calling in tonight?
Sexulous here on the line.
Sexulous. Straight from Jamaica. How you doing, miss?
Good.
Good. Did you call in? Did you have a question for our Canadian heavyweight champion, ma'am?
Yes, sir. I do.
Well, let's hear it.
I want to know, although you manage to the mental aspect of facing such a powerful opponent in the ring, knowing one punch can change your life?
That's a good question.
Completely.
Well, that's a great question, madam. I'll tell you, every day that I get ready to compete, when I get up, as soon as I open my eyes, I'm making my peace with my creator at that point. That could be the day that I'm being called home to atone for my transgressions in this earth. And so every day that I get up and I get ready to fight, I'm walking out the door and I'm good with the fact that that could be the last time I ever walk in that door. Because I know that the person that did sign that contract to fight me is trying to kill me, right? And so how can I take that lightly, right? So I guess the answer is that I train to put myself in a position that I don't have to worry about that punch coming from the next man. He's got to worry about what I'm going to do.
There you go.
Mm.
That's the champion talking right there.
Mm.
He's got to worry about me.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answered your question.
Yes, thank you, Sexulous, for the call. We appreciate you listening.
Yeah. So now check this out. Fast forward 5 years. I'm 16 years old now, right? I got myself in trouble with the law because at 13 I ended up leaving home. You know, I was a ward of the court by then, and so I was actually on my own in child services. Was giving me the $500 a month they'd give foster parents to look after you.
Right? Mm.
So rent was $495, right?
Mm.
And if I didn't go to school and boxing every day, then they would withhold my check at the end of the month. We'd have to have an intervention, and I'd have to come down and talk about it, right?
Mm.
But, you know, rent was $495, right? So the $5 that
you
I
got
had...
$5.
Right, to survive on, right?
Yeah,
it was one of those things I kind of turned a blind eye to.
Mm.
So you fast forward 5 years later, and... you make a bunch of bad decisions. Eventually, you make one that you can't get yourself out of.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I found myself in a situation with other people involved and, you know, in a situation where I probably shouldn't have even been there. But opportunities struck. And, you know, I think the greedy mind and the opportunist as a young man that doesn't really think through all of the potential consequences of their actions, right?
Mm-hmm. So you're a young man, of course, and, you're not thinking
that. And jumped on it, and unfortunately, we walked into a scenario where an individual lost their life that night, and a number of lives were ruined as a result of it, right?
Mm.
And it took a long time for me to figure out and to be able to understand the why that kind of stuff happened, right?
Mm.
And that actually kind of brings me into how I ended up touching getting to know Digi way, way on the back end there. But it was really interesting because as I'm sitting in a young offender segregation cell, because they left me in seg the whole time I was there until I pled out. And I pled guilty to second-degree murder, and I was sentenced and sent to the adult system by the time I was 17 years old.
Mm.
And so I started 17. My time off in Renouse, New Brunswick, which is the maximum security prison.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was kind of my beginning beginning to what a life sentence looked like.
Mm.
And so
at the blink of an eye, it all changed, right?
Yeah.
And it's crazy, right? Because there's a lot of young brothers and sisters going through it right now, right? They're not really thinking about, the consequences, the future, what's going to happen, right? But, even just hearing that, how inspiring is that to those who are listening, right? Because, they incarcerate you, right? Mm-hmm. It's like that saying, trap my body, but can't lock my mind. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you rose above that.
Well, that was what helped get me through it. It's like, I made a horrible mistake, and there was a lot of situational factors that led to that, right? Essentially being a young man having to support myself on $5, I'm always looking for an opportunity to make a quick buck, right?
Of course.
And so, my story is not all that different from a lot of people out there. It doesn't matter what color it is, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I come from an unfortunate upbringing where there was a lack of stability and guidance and nurturing and stuff like that, right?
Did you have a father in your life back then, Jay?
No, I never met my father, right? My grandfather was the only father figure that I had. And when he died in 91, 92, that was really kind of where I lost my way, right? And the world kind of started to raise me up, right? So, I think it's one of those things that even before then, I experienced, every kind of abuse you can imagine, right? Physical, emotional, sexual, mental, financial. And so, that's what helped shape the young man that was 16 years old at that, that situation that night.
He's probably really angry, too.
Yeah, and I think, the reality is that I've never really had an instance where I have spoke about the situation publicly, right, in almost 30 years. But a lot of people don't really understand what really did kind of happen, right? And so, when you're a young man going to hang out with some girls that are like teenage girls too, right, and a guy is like almost 40s, like giving them drugs and alcohol, trying to like party with them and kind of barricading the guy down the stairs, you're left kind of with a negative impression of that individual, right, when you've experienced some of the traumas that I did prior to that night, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, when you see somebody that's presenting, sexually predatory behavior when you've been preyed on yourself,
an
right?
adult, yeah.
That's a trigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it took a long time for me to understand that, because after the situation occurred, I turned myself in, pled guilty, took my lumps on the chin, and just wanted to move forward with my life, right?
Yeah.
But you learn in the system that they don't want healing to occur. They don't want the victims to heal from it, because the system's been using them to get the conviction and to make sure that they get the money off of you when you're in the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
you're speaking of money. What do you mean by money the system gets off of you when you're in there? What does that mean by that?
Like right now, everyone in Canada that pays their taxes, myself included, is paying for the incarceration of offenders in this country, right?
True, indeed.
So let's say on the street when you're on parole, like they get $45,000 a pop for every person on
parole. That's right.
Per head, right?
That's on
right.
parole.
Yeah.
Right.
So you might not even see your PO. You might see your PO four times a year if you've built that much credibility. So they get $45,000 for four visits a year.
Mm-hmm. 10,000 a visit.
Yeah. And so,
apparently those offenders get paid more for the offenders too.
The well, people yeah, locked up.
Inside,
yes.
It's ridiculous. Like in a Supermax, they get paid 120 plus thousand a head.
Mm-hmm.
In a max, per inmate, it's like 90 to 110.
Wow.
It's 60 to 90, I think, in a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like 45 to 60 in a medium in or a minimum.
Yeah.
So they're like, it's the human cattle industry.
True indeed.
Right? And so
it is a money business.
There's a lot of people that shouldn't even be in prison. They smoked weed and they didn't have just, a marijuana card.
You know what I mean? Just pulled that out of my mind, bro. I was just thinking that all of the brothers and sisters that got locked up for the chronic, and now it's legalized and they're still inside.
Well, and with part of my story, that kind of paralleled, right? Like I got out and because of the 20 years incarcerated, you know what I mean? You end up developing symptoms of PTSD and stuff like that.
Of course you do.
Yeah. You know, I had 7 trips to a max with no violence on my file. Like, how do you get sent to a max 7 times without doing anything violent to get sent there or be involved in any violence when you're
and
there?
And even as a young man yourself, they're putting you in there with some adult grown offenders.
Mm-hmm.
They're throwing you in with the sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I learned how to do time from the old heads that were kind of dying off, like the guys that were involved in the riots and the hostage takings in the 60s and 70s and 80s in prison to try and get the CCRAs and the RRs, which are the rules that govern and fair treatment of people incarcerated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those guys really kind of helped me understand how to carry myself, right? But really, it was a lot of common sense. Like, I mean, I came in with what I guess a lot of people would have considered a street code or a G code. You know, I spent 20 years inside, and I went to a max 7 times. I was in general population every single time, you know?
GP.
The whole way through. And, you know, like, like I can tell you, the system don't like that, right? The system tries to break you from the second you come in. So the first thing they want to get you to do is to ask them for protection and safety, because then you're controllable. You're malleable.
PC. Right? Mm-hmm.
So everyone that you know that's been in PC that made the choice to go ask the prison guards for protection because they needed to be protected for their safety, right? They probably regretted that decision, I would imagine, because forevermore now, they were essentially made a deal with the devil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they got to run and hide. They can't get put here. They can't get put there. So I always looked at it this way. I don't care who's waiting for me when I come up the line. I'm going to be out in the yard with my shoes laced up. Never had a shank in 20 years. Never had a crew. Never ran with a gang. I walked the yard by myself, and I got along with everybody respectively, right?
Mm-hmm.
I did my time, and I literally carried myself on the street the same way I did inside.
Mm-hmm.
I let everybody do their thing. I let them be them.
Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Bryant, it shows in your personality. You are the champion, and there's nobody that can take that away from you, sir. I commend you for taking responsibility for your actions, you know, and speaking up and being sorry for your actions and realizing the mistakes in what you did. You know, and then also at the same time, we got to commend you for protecting the young ladies out there from, you know,
predators,
essentially, malcontent. And, you know, sometimes we don't even get to tell the truth about a story, and sometimes it just looks an ill way. But, you know, I got to say, manning up is manning up. You know, and you turned yourself in as a 17-year-old young man. You did 20 years. GP walked out of there and made a better time for yourself. You're showing out better. That you are on life parole. You will never not be on parole. They have you.
That's right.
So every day they talk to you or call you to come in, they're testing you, they're checking you.
Absolutely.
And in all of that, still, my man,
standing on your square,
brother. I see 4 belts in here. I see 4 belts in here. Let me tell you, I am a heavyweight man. And I don't want your belts because I seen you train, bro. I don't want those belts, buddy. But you know what?
Step in the ring,
represent. You know,
man.
Proud to know you, sir. You're a great man, and I really commend you for all that you've done and showing us how to turn things around. Even, you know, that's a big change, my man.
Inspiration's a big thing for people, right? Doesn't matter what age you are, right?
True indeed.
Yeah. You know?
I've gotten a lot of positive feedback in the last couple of years, and particularly with the success I've had, you know, like the 20 years off and then coming back and winning the 2018 provincials and the 2019 BC Golden Gloves before I turned pro. I was, you know what I mean? I was looking at the beginnings of a potential Olympic qualifying round. You know, I would have potentially been going to the Nationals. I would have been going to the Nationals in 2019, which was an Olympic qualifying year. But unfortunately, because of my career path and some of the, I guess, objections from the other side of the equation, and also that there was some peripheral involvement with part of the sport, basically I didn't get to go to the Nationals in 2019, and I got suspended, and they tried to send me back. And if it wasn't for a dear friend taking care of my legal fees, then you wouldn't be having this conversation, and those straps wouldn't even been here, because corrections would have basically buried me inside again, right? So, you know, when you come to prison, certainly you
God is great.
God is great. And, you know, the truth is that that's the only reason I'm here doing what I'm doing, is just that I believe that I got a purpose, and that that purpose is essentially being unfolded through what I'm doing, through the application of me living my life and learning the things that I had to, and finding a way to communicate that and to educate people and to share a little bit about my story. If it stops a couple of people from going down the wrong path, then everything that I went through in my life was not in vain, right? And if it doesn't save anybody else in the world, it saved me, so it wasn't in vain.
Bro, even if they go down the wrong path, though, man, they could see your way back up.
Yeah.
Either way you look at it, brother, you are saying a lot with your walk, you know, and your talk, champion. Because I don't see, again, nobody trying to take those belts from you, bro.
No, it's, you know, I don't, no one's calling my name, but, you know, the flip side of it is, you know, I've been a champion for a year. Right now, we got no sponsors, we got no financial backing in the community. I got no promoter, no financial backer. I got my manager, like I said, who's an international sports agent and matchmaker. He actually did some fights on the Mike Tyson, Roy Jones undercard a few years back. So, you know, he's really specialized what he does too, Danny McGarvey. And, you know, he's an older gentleman too. He's in his 60s, and he's been in a wheelchair for over 30 years as well. And so, you know, another guy that's really inspirational to me is, you know, you're in a tough guy sport, and you're dealing with a disadvantage, you know what I mean? And you have to find a way to still get your respect and get the job done. And there's probably not a better guy at building shows and eyeing up talent and making fights out there right now than my guy. So, you know, I just know sooner or later, the only thing we're missing is the financial backing, right? At some point, that independent business owner that's financially set, that's heard my story, that likes what I'm doing inside and outside of the ring, that understands the value in that story, and the potential for him to be able to capitalize on that too financially going down the stretch, right? That person's out there. I know they are. Maybe I've met them and they're just still kind of waiting.
Just say they're waiting on the fence. They're going to miss out though, man. Pretty Boy Floyd. He's building in a lot of money, you know. Pretty Boy Floyd Mayweather makes a lot of money off this boxing without even boxing anymore. But, you know, we're not calling you Pretty Boy Jay, but you got a package to run, star. You know, if anybody's listening, you know, this is the man you need to talk to. Like, why don't we go into, like, I know when you started on your journey to the belts, it wasn't an easy road.
No
sir. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's been a real uphill battle. You know, there's been a few promotional companies locally in BC that kind of rose and fizzled out, right? And, you know, being that I'm not from BC, even though I've been here 25 years, I think there's still a challenge trying to, like, break through and to be kind of, like, accepted and, like, embraced by the community, right? Because, you know, it's just unfortunate. Like I said, I've been a champ for a year. I haven't been invited to a single boxing club out here. You know what I mean? Yeah. And really, that's their loss, because, you know, in Ontario or other places where there's a lot of professional boxing champions, you know what I mean? These guys give those kind of guys free tickets because they want those guys at the fights, because those are the guys everybody wants to take pictures with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you know, it's unfortunate that the guys out here really haven't been able to understand like legitimate business practices and the value of competition and how that actually is healthy for your business. Instead, people just try and, you know, once again, it's the crab bucket syndrome, right? And when people don't embrace you when you're doing good things, right, that tells you everything you need to know, bro.
True indeed.
So, like, that's why I don't go tripping around to no boxing clubs, right? If you ain't invited me by now, you ain't even worthy of my presence.
That's a class factor, right?
Real
and
talk.
And that's what we need. I mean, it goes on in the music, too, right? Like, the class, right? We have to uplift the class, right? And we have to set a standard. And, you know, we're setting it with you, my brother. You know what I'm saying?
But Guilty, didn't we talk about earlier today, we were talking about another Canadian champion we once had that actually had to leave the country to get his Just Goods. We lost him. I mean, he fought as a Canadian heavyweight. We're talking about Lennox. Lewis.
We were talking Lennox about
Lewis.
Him.
Lennox Lewis.
I was just going to actually ask Jay the question of what would it take for you to go after the heavyweight championship of the world?
Great question. I mean, right now, I'm 8th in the world in the NABF, North American Boxing Federation.
What?
Yeah, that's the sister organization to
Yo,
the NABC.
Man. 8th?
8th?
Yeah. Man, that's not far off, my brother.
You know?
But perspective is that I should be higher than that because that 8th ranking doesn't take into consideration my knockout win in September.
Two fights you're talking about?
No, the one fight. I got ranked after winning the Canadian title last year, but then I fought in September. I knocked Buddy out in a minute and 34
That's
seconds.
That's right, yep.
And I still haven't been ranked since then. So they actually need to update that ranking. I should be higher, right? But, like, put it into perspective, like, that last fight that I had in Montreal, that fight, the bill just for that fight, just the expenses attached to that fight, not the rest of the card, was over $26,000.
And you have to cover that all yourself?
Somebody's got to cover that.
Mm.
Right? So, like, you know, Sean was talking about in the beginning, like, there's been instances where to maybe to push things along and to get it over the hump, we've had to actually kick in and cover some of the expenses, right?
Just to make it happen.
Yeah, like you think, hey, in pro boxing, you shouldn't be paying.
You should be making money.
Yeah. But the reality is that when you don't have sponsors, when you don't have a promoter, when you don't have a financial backer, somebody's got to pay those bills to make that fight happen, right? So, you know, once again, understanding the business and the economics of it has been a blessing in disguise for me because of my manager, because, like, most people will be upset and frustrated and trying to spin their tires. I know what, I don't like it. I know what it says and what it is, so what am I going to do about it? That's my approach, right? So, okay, you guys don't want to sign me, you don't want to, okay, fine. You know what? I'm going to find another way, and that's what I've done. I've had to cover a lot of the expenses, you know what I mean? My massage therapies, you know, trips to Toronto, you know, cost me like $4,000 out of my own pocket to get sparring and stuff, right? These guys that are there, they got people putting them in the game. They got people helping them financially, you know what I mean? Like, perspective is I've climbed 1,350 spots in less than 2 years.
Wow.
So Mike Tyson climbed 1,500 and some spots in the 80s and won a world title in that same stretch. So I'm in the same pace and clip as far as rise.
Yes.
But I'm also being canceled because of that historical factor. You know what I'm saying?
I was just going to ask you now. You dealing with that discrimination again because of your history.
So, yeah. So, once again, like I said, the discrimination comes in all shapes and sizes, right?
Yeah.
I started my pro career off 0-4.
That's right.
And then I fired everybody that I was working with and started coaching and training myself. And I went 8-0 with 8 knockouts and won 4 pro titles. Right? And so now, right, I'm not worried about getting a coach until I get to a point where I actually feel collectively between me and my manager, I think we need to have another pair of eyes helping us on this one.
Yeah.
Right? But nobody's ever coached themselves to 8 straight knockout wins, or let alone 1. Nobody's ever coached themselves to professional boxing. Nobody's ever taken 20 years off of boxing and come back and won professional titles, amateur titles, or even won a fight. No one's ever come back from 20 years off of boxing, period.
How long was Ali out? It was
Ali
a couple.
Was for what, 3 years?
Yeah.
Three years,
Foreman,
yeah.
It was like a decade or so. He came back to basically, you know, to help finance and fund the community center that he had had going, right? So so that was really the why he got back into it. So, you know, taking George Chavallo's record, you know, last year just motivated me now to take George Foreman's record. And that, you know, I'm going to have that record. As
George Travolta, he fought Ali, too. That was a fight in Vancouver, correct?
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, he was 39, I think, so I had almost 4 years on him, senior to him, mm-hmm. when I took that record. And so, you know, George Foreman was 45. So realistically, where I'm at right now, it's going to take at least a year to be in a position to potentially be fighting for a world title, because people are going out of their way to avoid us right now.
Mm.
Those guys that are in the top 100, nobody's calling our name because no one wants to get bumped out of the top 100.
They're trying to age you out, man.
Yeah, but the thing is that I'm actually getting younger right now. Every fight I've had in my pro career, 12 fights, I've come in lighter every single time. Right? That's another thing. You'll never find anyone in history that's ever done that. These things are just such abnormalities to the conventional way of doing things that's what's got everybody pissed off, right? How many coaches out there right now probably even listening to this, and they sit there beating their chest in their gym trying to get everybody to look up to them like the demigods, like there's no way you're going to advance as a fighter without their knowledge, and then here's this guy that just comes in and does it himself.
Yeah.
Right? But like, what they don't understand is I still had 6 years of training with Olympic team coaches and Olympians around me. And then I had 20 years of sitting there practicing my craft and preparing for this opportunity to take advantage of it. Right? And then I get out and realize I got no help whatsoever, and that literally it's like the world's double down on trying to like kill my shine. So all that just did was motivate me even more to dig in even harder. Right?
That's strength, man. That's a strong human being.
So can you tell me, you gonna give any diet tips? And like, what's your regimen that keeps you lean and keeps you disciplined without a coach and all that stuff?
Well, I think it's kind of deceptive in what I said, because like while I was inside, you know, I went back, I did my upgrading, I ended up paying for my post-secondary after winning a human rights complaint for spiritual infringement inside, and then took the money that I had left over after I paid for my personal training courses and stuff, and I had married my junior high sweetheart on our 20-year anniversary, right? And so that's basically how I had set myself up to try and invest in the future. And so, you know, my uncle, I had an uncle, he's a certified historian and an author. And, you know, he'd bring me into his den when I was younger, and it was just, I could still feel the cloud of anxiety over my head every time I seen him. Because it's like, son, get in here. And it's like, oh, jeez, I'm going to get talked at. How education's important and this and that and black history this and black culture that. And you're just like, yes, okay. Right? But like, he was one of those influences, right, that 6, 7 years, 8 years later, while I'm sitting inside and I got to make a decision on what I'm going to do with my life, right, I could hear his voice saying, Jay, education, that is the most important thing. And I didn't have support, I didn't have money, I didn't have resources. When I was manifesting what's happening right now, I knew I wasn't going to have a coach, trainer, a dietitian, this, that. I was going to have to be that. So I invested in my education, and really that's what helped set me up, so that when I got out, I ended up working for Steve Nash Fitness World.
Okay.
Continued more education with them.
Okay.
Stevie Nash.
Yeah, and then, you know, they did me a huge favor. They illegally fired us all during the COVID pandemic. And then they offered us a job back, basically at a reduced rate with less perks, right? So I took that opportunity just to go it on my own. So I designed and engineered Jab Fitness, the home business gym that I have.
Okay.
And then, you know, had to kind of expand on that a little bit. So I've got what I do believe to be the only detachable boxing ring scenario. So my functional space converts into a boxing ring as well. So I got detachable ropes that I can set up the ring for the training and stuff like that for the guys that are taking it a little more seriously. I do almost all of my sparring in BC in my own gym at home, right? So, you know, it's kind of, it's that vision of self, right? That same vision I told you about, right? That vision could have just as easily been me holding up that green and gold WBC belt as a world title and not Muhammad Ali. But part of that vision also was being a champion, being a heavyweight champion, and waking up and going downstairs to my gym. mm-hmm. and doing my training for my training camps in my gym, mm-hmm. right? So essentially everything that I dreamt of when I was a kid, I've managed to manifest it into fruition, except for the millions of dollars and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, that's not a priority.